emphasis on graphics software development for medical, scientific, and educational applications and the arts. So he's the lead software developer for Virtual Puget Sound, which is an oceanographic visualization tool. Education is a master's in computer science and a bachelor's degree in mathematics. And he's going to be talking about visualization of marine models. So we'll take just a second and hook him up to this microphone. If you want to hook it low, there's a little clip just in the second button. Yeah, that's great. And that can just sit right there.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank Dr. Livingston for the invitation to speak here at the Water Center. I first became interested in water as an infant, but then after that, in seventh grade, I read a book, Water, the Mirror of Science. And one fact I particularly remember from that book is a property that water has, unlike most other substances. When most substances, when they get cold, they contract. Water does that for the most part, except when it gets close to freezing. Then it expands. Right around 4 degrees, it starts to expand, and when it becomes forms ice crystals, it increases in density by about decreases in density by about 9%. That's a very significant fact about water. As a consequence of that, water floats. Frozen water floats on top of liquid water. And that has a great significance to life on this planet. Bodies of water, rather than freezing from the bottom up, freeze from the top down. So that's something got me interested in water at an early age. The importance of water, I think we're all aware that water is essential to human life. I think we can safely say that's a fairly globally understood concept. On the other hand, the challenges to water quality, the need to protect it, and the underlying scientific principles. How does water move? How does it work? What are the dynamics, short-term, long-term, and globally, of water? That's a little bit more elusive, perhaps mysterious in ways, and not necessarily widely understood. How do we impact water as a global community and as individuals? We're tuned into that, but maybe not fully. How can we extend our understanding of these principles to know how we as a community and society relate to water? What? I have an impact? Now, I'm sure everybody in this room realizes that they have an impact in their choices, their lifestyles, individual actions, impact our environment. But perhaps a five-year-old is not even aware that they do have an impact. And that impact is a little bit, there's something elusive about that too. I perform an action here, and it has the impact somewhere else, maybe later in time. So I think our understanding of that may need to start at an early age. And sometimes the fact that action takes a place at a distance. If I flush the toilet here, it comes out over there. How do we learn about this? How do we extend the scientific knowledge that we have developed over the years and our increasing understanding about water and the environment? How do we extend that to reach out to society as a whole and the general public so that they can understand, everyone can understand and make choices on their actions individually and globally. Everyone's heard of global warming, but I think there's a great amount of mystery that surrounds that. I think maybe a lot of people feel, well, things are going to get warmer, okay? I think as a result of that notion that global warming is about, the main impact here is about warming, has led many people to talk about climate change rather than global warming. That the impact of warming is going to increase the number of storms and have other impacts that aren't necessarily associated with warming per se. And I think maybe even fewer people realize that the impact of climate change may be one of the greatest impacts and maybe the first one that will be widely felt if the situation gets much worse is that there'll be a water crisis. Many people throughout the world will have their water supplies cut off. If the glaciers melt, if the snowpacks change significantly, and so water is really at the heart of what's going on in climate change. Well, I'm not going to talk too much more about climate change, but while we're on the topic, I wanted to just recommend a few movies about the subject. Perhaps most of you have seen An Inconvenient Truth. The Age of Stupid is a more recent release. In fact, I don't think it's even quite in a wide release yet, but I would Google that. It's maybe only been in a few screenings here. And it has a bit of a documentary fiction blend. It talks about climate change from the perspective of the future, looking back at this age, wondering whether why we made the choices that we made. And I found it quite compelling. I was moved by An Inconvenient Truth. After seeing The Age of Stupid, I started turning lights out. So I found it a very compelling approach to the topic. Encounters at the Edge of the World is not... that's a typo there. Edge of the World. It's not about climate change per se. It's a documentary by Werner Herzog, who went down to Antarctica and to visit the people who live and work down there. But it definitely, eventually in the movie, a thread emerges about the nature of humanity in this world and the potential that our time on this planet is not infinite. And a very compelling movie as well. On the topic of visualization of natural phenomenon and movement of water, I would recommend the movie Rivers and Tides. It's now from a perspective of a sculptor, Andy Goldsworthy. It's a documentary about Goldsworthy and his work. And he does sculptures in nature of natural forms. And there's a few scenes in that movie that really reflect movement of water, particle advection, from an artistic perspective. And it's also quite compelling. Why visualization? Well, I think one of the challenges to our understanding of nature is that we don't always see the underlying processes. They take place at a time frame that is different from our normal day-to-day perception of time. We can see the water, but can we see its salinity or its temperature or its movement on different time frames? So, if we look at scientific principles from the perspective of numerical models or data, we see a bunch of numbers, but can we translate that into what we see, translate that into what's actually going in the natural phenomenon? So visualization tools provide a link to from our perceptual system to what's going on in these scientific processes. And here are a few goals for the work we're doing with visualization of marine models. We want to increase our understanding of the marine processes and how human activity and policy affect the environment. Visualization also provides a tool that facilitates the creation of scientific hypotheses. When one's looking at a visualization, one's not actually looking at the phenomenon itself. One's looking at a representation. So I hesitate to say that we're going to discover visualizations allow you to prove a theory. But what they do provide is a way to see, at least from the point of view of a representation, some underlying principles at work and generate a hypothesis. If one sees a pattern in the visualization, it can inspire one to create a new theory, a conjecture, a hypothesis about what is going on, and then go out into the real world to test that hypothesis. And it's a form of communication. Visualization tools can extend our understanding to reach a larger audience, including policymakers, students, and the general public. In some ways, it's a bridge between the science and the scientists and the general public and policymakers. So it's a form, if one can take the scientific theories that are perhaps numerical and translate them into a form that is compelling, illustrates what's going on at the underlying level of the phenomena, and reach a larger audience, that could have a great impact on how we globally as a community understand what's going on in our environment. All right, I'm going to switch modes here to some demos of some of these tools that I'm talking about. So I'm going to... Whoops, hold on a second. It'll take me a second to fire this up here. The tool I'm launching here is a program called Virtual Puget Sound. It was developed a number of years ago, initially as an immersive system with head-mounted displays. And the principle at work was, in the initial versions, we were exploring how can... to relate the comparison between immersive systems and desktop systems as a tool for understanding complex phenomena. So here we are at... Oh, hang on just a second. I need to plug in the next space. Okay, Virtual Puget Sound is a visualization tool that enables 3D navigation to visualize oceanographic data sets based on numerical models. So let's fly in a little bit here, and I'm going to just zoom to the next viewing spot here. And let's turn on one of the data sets here that represents some oceanographic data sets from Puget Sound. I'm going to start time here. For younger audiences, I often ask, what is that we're looking at? What is that floating around in the water? Every now and then I hear fish. I know that I'm sure that in this audience, everyone will recognize those as vectors that represent the flow of water in Puget Sound. The ability to navigate under the water provides a different perspective on some of these data sets. Now, a question that I often ask audiences here is, okay, the length of the vectors represents the velocity of the water, of course. And a question that often comes to mind is, why in this channel here, the arrows seem to be longer there than elsewhere? Why would the current be faster in that channel there? Any theories? Well, I've had one theory that's been proposed is that it's closer to the ocean, but I think the prevailing understanding of that is that the channel is narrower. And the analogy that I sometimes make is if you imagine you have a garden hose turned on and you stick your thumb over the garden hose, there's the same volume of water coming out, but it has to go through a narrower channel. If you look at the cross-section area, if the total flow is the volume divided by the cross-section area, if you have a smaller cross-section area, you need to have a greater velocity. And so that's an explanation of why the circulation, this is Admiralty Inlet, which is an area that has some of the greatest tides in the Puget Sound region. Okay, so... we see the arrows are pointing. I don't know if you can see the tips of the arrows at this distance. It's a little bit hard to tell where the... Can you see the tips of the arrows? Let me see if I can scale that up a little bit. Hang on a second. Okay, is that a little easier to see the arrowheads? Okay. Okay, so the water's flowing. Let me back up a little bit here. Oh, that's a good question here. This slider here represents, and I'm going to put a tide chart on here. Well, this is one day's passage in, I guess, a few seconds here. So we're speeding up the flow of time. That's something that needs to be understood, so that's a good question to ask. And so I think it's important when one shows a visualization like this to display that passage of time rate. I think in one class that we showed this to, people thought that that movement was related to the wave movement. Because that's the type of movement we're used to seeing when we look at water. The time frame of the cycle of crashing waves. This is happening at a much slower rate. We're looking at a day repeated over and over again in a matter of seconds. I guess it would be good for me to actually have that as a number down there, days per second. So we see the water, the arrows. I'm going to show, let's see if I can get to where we can see Puget Sound a little more readily here. Okay, so there's the main channel, the main basin of Puget Sound. This is Whidbey Island here, Everett right here. And so when the arrows in their daily cycle are, they're pointing in, they're pointing out. They're pointing in, they're pointing out. When is high tide? Is it when the arrows are pointing in? Yeah. When they're pointing out? Let's do science by democracy here. Who thinks it's when the arrows are pointing in? Okay. Who thinks high tide is when the arrows are pointing out? Who thinks it's neither? Okay. So democracy has it, it's when the arrows are pointing in, but I think we may need to explore that a little more closely. And let me clarify a little bit, defining high tide. By high tide right now, I mean the highest water level. Okay. Let's think about it. Let's say you're sitting in your bathtub, and oceanographers often cringe when I start comparing Puget Sound to a bathtub. Puget Sound is not a bathtub. That being said, oceanographers will often use something called a box model, which is a simplification of a complex system into something that's a little more abstract, but represents the underlying principles. You're in your bathtub, and the water's running. What's happening to the water level? It's going up. Okay, now let's say you slowly turn the water off and pull the plug. Now the water level's going down. When was it at its highest point? Okay, let's take a look at some data here that may represent this phenomenon. Let me zoom back in to navigate down to this point here. Okay, let's put a tide chart up here. Okay, so I'm going to now, I've got time moving here, but I'm going to stop time. Oh, stop. Okay, and I'm going to dial in with this slider here the time of day. So let's dial it to where the arrows are pointing in at their longest. Okay, that looks like it's right about there. They're pointing at the longest. Let's look at the tide that's associated with that. It's not at its highest water level. It does seem like it's at the highest slope, the increase of the water level. Let's go a little further to where on the tide chart it is at its highest. That seems to be kind of where they're turning around. And now the water's flowing out. As the water's flowing out, the water level decreases. They're at its largest, they're pointing out with the greatest velocity around here, where the water is not at the lowest level, but as that's the greatest slope, decreasing level. So a visualization like this can illustrate the difference between a quantity and its derivative, a position compared to its velocity. And it can also change one's perspective of a scientific principle, and can alter one's worldview. Maybe I'll use the word misconception. I know through the use of this virtue Puget Sound, I've had many of my misconceptions about how water moves in Puget Sound changed as a result of looking at this tool. So democracy needs to be overturned here. If we accept this model that the highest water level is not when the water is moving at the fastest rate, it's when it's changing. Changing from going out to going in. Okay, so let's look at a few other things that this tool can represent. Okay. Let's start time again, and let's... hold on a second. Okay. What are those two things floating in the water? Those are not fish either. What they are particle release points. Now, the other day this crashed when I tried this, so if it does, I'll have to restart. Okay, we're flushing the toilet, and out comes particles. Now, what happens? Okay, one of these is, let me go under the water, is at deep water. One of these is under the water, so let's go underneath here. Okay, is the water moving the same at the surface as down below? Actually, if we take a look at this visualization to see what happens at those two levels, we'll notice, let me restart that. The water at the surface is tending to move out Admiralty Inlet, and the water down below is moving in a different direction. And these particles are being moved by the same circulation vectors, by the same circulation represented by these vectors, but the water movement below is different from what's at the surface. This is related to density and related to the architecture, as it were, or the bathymetry of the bottom of the Puget Sound. And this visualization tool can illustrate, through this numerical model, how this water is moving. Why is it important to know what happens with particles in Puget Sound? Are there particles floating around Puget Sound?
Yes.
Are there any that we put there? Yes. And this particular visualization was designed initially for a class laboratory to explore where would be a good place to put the outflow of a sewage treatment plant. And the goal certainly would be you don't want the sewage to be washing up on shore. In order to make a decision, a policy decision like that, it seems important to know the underlying principles of what's going on with water movement. And a visualization tool such as this can shed some light, inspire the creation of hypotheses that then need to be tested out in the real world. I do want to point out that this the data you're looking at here is based on model output. By that I mean numerical computational model that's mathematically based, rather than the distinction is a database model from captured data that's measured data from the field. The model is called the Princeton Ocean Model. It's based on measurements taken at sparse locations, including the bathymetry of the sound, takes tides into account, and takes input at boundary conditions of water going in and out of the sound, and then numerically integrates to create a data point for a grid of points throughout Puget Sound. So we're looking at a mathematical model here, not captured data. And I think that's an important distinction. Okay. There are some other visualizations in this tool. I think I'm going to move to another. Let me go back here a second. This tool allows us to represent other things such as salinity and temperature, various outputs from this model, different depth levels, and creates an interface for exploring and navigating these data sets. In some ways, one can take a virtual field trip that parallels perhaps a field trip one might take in a and an actual physical world field trip. I'm going to move on to a different visualization tool here that maybe many of you are familiar with, and that is Google Earth. Perhaps Virtual Puget Sound reminded some of you of Google Earth, in some ways a precursor to that, in the sense that it has a 3D navigation, an interface for adding data layers. And now we see that type of tool in a program like Google Earth that's now distributed globally to desktops around the world. Let's start our tour here at UW. And let's take a field trip now to some other points where we can look at some other data sets here. Okay. I've taken some of the visualizations that we produced in Virtual Puget Sound and exported them into a format that Google Earth can now import. And so let's look at some of these data sets. Here's a visualization done of circulation in Port Susan. And hold on a second. And this visualization was developed by researchers at Pacific Northwest Laboratory. Tarang Kayangokar and Zhaozing Yang produced this data set. You might notice something different about this than the data sets in Virtual Puget Sound. In Virtual Puget Sound, the grid points of the data were on a rectilinear grid. And this is on a non-uniform grid, which allows one to concentrate data points around points of high curvature, such as the shoreline. So it becomes a little more accurate to do things that way. And let's look at... hold on a second. Takes a few seconds to load some of these data sets in here. Hello? Okay. This is a simulation of deep space. No. Black hole. Okay. I don't know why this is taking so long here. Oh, I see what I did. Oh, no. Oh, no. here we go. Okay. Come into life here. I think I hit the wrong button. Okay. Pardon me for that. Okay, so Google Earth has a facility where if you input data sets that have time stamps on them, it will automatically put a timeline on there that allows you to now. Okay, I'm having technical difficulties here. It's no good when you hit the wrong button. So it allows you to visualize time series data if you put timestamps on the data sets here. Okay. One compelling thing about Google Earth is, as you know, you can zoom right into the landscape. Let me zoom in here. And I think people become a little more aware when they see these things happening right next to where they're living. Now there's a little more relationship now between what's happening in the data out in the water and what's happening in our communities where we live. So now there's a bridge between the data and our living environment. That can be compelling when you're trying to make a policy decision, when you're trying to... relate your policy to what the general public is interested in. Let's look at another scenario here. Let's see where we're going here. Okay. Okay. Now, okay, here we are on, hang on a second. Okay, here we are on Alki Point. And this boat here sprung a leak, and oil is spilling from it. Now, a question that may come to mind is, how do we respond to that? Where do we have the hazmat crew is heading out and with their gear, containment booms, etc., but they need to know where to deploy them. That decision is going to depend a little bit on where the water is moving. Is that oil spill going to hit Alki Point, or is it going to be washed out to sea? Well, knowing where the water is going is a significant fact to that. So let's turn on the vector layer. And okay, the data says, from the model, indicates that that oil slick is heading this way, and that it's going to head right towards the tip of Alki Point. And this is how long it's going to take to get there. There's my house. It's just going to just miss my house, but it's certainly going to be a mess down by the waterfront. And hold on a second. Oh, I'm hitting the wrong buttons here. Okay, and there's the oil slick, and it does then hit right out of Alki Point, and I'm sure the people here right by the tip are going to care about what happens to this oil slick. The impact that we make by releasing particles like this into the sound is significant. Now, who here heard about this oil slick that happened last summer off of Alki Point? Okay, I didn't hear about it because this is a fiction. This is a visual representation that I created as a point of drama to show that that the impact of oil spills is significant. When you read about it in the paper, it's one thing. When you see what would happen if it hit your house, it's a little bit more compelling. It may be a call for action. I raise that point that visualization can be misleading, and I think we need to be very aware of, upfront about what we're expressing with these. If it's a model based on numerical calculations rather than captured data, I think it's important to represent that. It's important to be aware of the distinction between a model based on a theory and actual data. Here, this is an artist's representation of what might happen in an oil slick. The people who do hazardous material response need to act very fast. They don't have time to translate data formats from one format to another. They need to get their information out to the people in the field quickly and in a format that they can understand. So that's one of the challenges of hazardous material response. Let me see how I'm doing on time here. I'm going to take my chances and show one more visualization here. If I can find it here. Let's head out to the coast. And here is a visualization from the Tsunami Research Center at NOAA. Gave away the punchline there. And here's a simulation of what would happen if a tsunami hit out on the shore, and I find it very compelling to now see the data merged in with photographic data that closely resembles our environment, and this, of course, would be a devastating occurrence if it actually happened. This is, of course, a simulation. For some reason, the numerical scale disappeared here that came with this data set, but I was noticing the swells up to 8 meters, which would be, of course, devastating. So these visualizations, combined with a tool that is broadly deployed on the internet, relatively easy to create data sets for, and represents not just data, but the world surrounding it that we're accustomed to seeing and looking at, I think is a very compelling way to bridge the science and simulations with our daily lives. Let's head back to UW here. Okay. Oh, that's not UW. The interface for Google Earth has a range of tools that allow you to make data sets for it. Right within the interface of Google Earth, there's some very simple things one can do, such as creating place marks for locations that you want to visit and make itineraries and tours for one's audience. And those are very easy to make right within the interface of Google Earth. One can basically create a place mark and go to the water center and place that over, well, I think it's over here by Anderson Hall. I'm going to just place it here for now. And you can create a description file that goes with that. And now that's a place mark that's in the virtual world that one can create data sets, save them as files that one can post on the internet. Someone clicks on that file, they can now go to your visualization. Now, if your data is numerical, such as vector sets, there's a fairly simple language called KML, which allows you to import ASCII data into, there's a variety of data, primitive data formats, vectors, polygons, etc., that allow you to create data sets directly and post them on the web. Why do I have a picture of the icosahedron here? Years ago, when I was an undergrad and studying mathematics, I was very interested in representing geodesic domes. A variety of geodesic dome is based on the icosahedron that's triangulated. So I wanted to learn more about the icosahedron, and so I went to the library and found this book, Lectures on the Icosahedron. Oh, gee. PowerPoint has stopped working. Go figure. Okay. I was interested in learning about the icosahedron. So I found this book, Lectures on the Icosahedron by Felix Klein, famous mathematician from the 19th century. I grabbed the book excitedly and leafed through it. And one thing I noticed, see what you notice about this book. Page ahead here. No pictures. I was astonished. Here's a book on geometry, on a shape that I wanted to study, and there's no pictures. And so I was scratching my head, why would that be the case? Well, there was a period of time when mathematicians were a little bit uneasy about pictures. They certainly didn't want to be doing proof by pictures, because pictures can be misleading. So certainly there was a period of time where all mathematics, or at least there was an approach to mathematics that was just symbolically based, not using pictures to do proofs. And I think this is something to consider when we make visual representations. I'm not saying we shouldn't do pictures, but we should understand a little bit what they mean. A visualization is not there to prove a theory. It's to represent it and allow one to create hypotheses, see underlying patterns. But to really, an important step is to go back to the real world and validate the data one sees, the visualizations one sees in representations of these data sets. I think it's very important to know the difference between a model, to understand a little bit the meaning of a model. And I think it's something to explore as you create these models in your work. Let's see if I can get Google, or let's see if I can get PowerPoint back here. It seems to have crashed. Hang on a second.
This may be a good point to ask for any questions.
Sure.
So,
Are there any questions? Yes.
Yeah, so you said it's just a mathematical model and not actual data. So does that mean that does it not take into account the changes in seasons, like the tides are different in the summer than they are in the winter?
I'm sorry, let me clarify. The one of the inputs to the mathematical model are data points. All those vectors that we saw on the grid, those individual vector values were not captured data. They were based on captured data at a sparse set of points. It would take too long to go and scan the entire sound to capture the input data, the velocity at all those points. This model starts with a few points and then integrates, interpolates to find values at different points. It does take seasons into account and tides. I think there are some general wind inputs, but it doesn't necessarily take the daily weather into account, so that's going to create some changes as well. And it's a good question, I think, what is represented. Any model is not going to capture all aspects of the natural phenomenon. Some things are going to be included, others left out. I think it's valuable to express that to one's audience and to keep it in mind and to heighten people's awareness that these are representations. And going back to the real world to verify when possible is great. One doesn't always have that opportunity. Sometimes one has to act fast based on uncertainty, based on the results of that model. So that's a good question. I appreciate that.
Any other questions? Yes.
I think it's the same question. Calibrating your model from actual data. Are you doing that now continually?
I believe whether it's continuing, this particular model, has had, there's been a process of verification. It seems to be seems to perform relatively well. I have to confess, I'm the visualization developer. I take the data in and represent it on the screen. So I don't know necessarily the details of where that underlying data came from. So I have to confess, I need to defer to the oceanographer who developed this model to really answer that question effectively. I believe this model has gone through a validation process that finds a relatively effective match to what's going on in nature. Yes?
Is virtual Puget Sound something that's available?
Why don't you contact me? It's been used in-house here at UW for laboratories and several oceanography classes. We're talking now to some of the folks at Tech Transfer here at UW to see about creating a public release. If you contact me, I can we can talk further about making that available. Yes?
Along with explaining where your data set came from, whether it's an interpolation from a few points or whether it's entirely captured data, is there a way to visually indicate where those points were that the data was captured from if it's being interpolated?
I'm guessing that probably could be done. I don't have that particular piece of data. When the oceanographer gave me the data set, that was not included in that particular data set. That, I think, would be valuable to represent that. In some ways, I think one needs to be very careful about how one represents these things. In some ways, fiction that's clearly fiction may be more honest than something that is trying to be not fiction, but has something fictitious about it. Something to be aware of, in any case. Yes?
In the Google Earth simulation, some of those vectors were flowing down city streets. Is that a prediction of where floodwaters would go?
No, that's a good question. I'm glad you pointed that out. The vectors are not the water itself. And that's something that can be misleading. I don't think I have Virtual Puget. I'm going to relaunch Virtual Puget Sound, see if I can represent something. Okay, hang on a second. Well, let me just talk through it. I'm having technical difficulties here. The vectors represent the velocity of the water, not the position of the water. So the tips of the vectors are not where the water is, but where the direction where it's headed. That can be misleading. I've seen cases, and I'll just try to use my hands as the vectors. The vectors are going out. The vectors are now coming back. Which way is the water going?
It looks like, when we look at the visualization from gut feeling, intuition, it sort of looks like it's coming back. But what's coming back is not the water itself, but the vectors. The vector is still pointing this way. The water is still going out. The vector is coming back. So one has to be aware of the difference between the actual vector and the position of the water. In some ways, I hit the wrong version of PowerPoint here. I'm using 2003, not 2007. If I have a minute, I'm going to relaunch Virtual Puget Sound here. So that representation of the vector needs to be run. I think it's important to understand that distinction. Oh, yes, I remember what I was going to say. Some of those vectors along the river were a lot longer than the ones in the water. Those represented river flow. And it does not mean that water is going up on the side of the bank. So that was not the case. While this is loading, any other questions? Okay.
Is this being used by any government, non-government, or is it still kind of in-house in the university?
It's more being used in-house, in academic, in educational class laboratories. The goal of this is outreach to reach a larger audience. We haven't quite got there yet with this particular tool. And I think one thing that represents is the need for, there's still a disconnect between the science, the policymakers, and the general public. There's a disconnect there. Part of that is based on some of the natures of the infrastructure of the academic world. Some of it is based on getting a tool to the point where a policymaker can have it on their desktop, easy to use. That's an important step. If they need to do a long installation, or the interface is cumbersome, that's a obstacle or challenge between using it for the scientists and using it for the policymakers. And so that's something that we need to overcome, and that's one of the challenges we face in building these visualization tools. I just wanted to show one last thing relative to that question about the vectors. So here the vectors are representing the flow in the Straits of Juan de Fuca. One misconception that I had clarified, that I had about tidal flow that this tool pointed out to me was, I thought with the tide changing, high tide, low tide twice a day, typically the vectors going in and out, I thought that happened everywhere. But here's some points where in the span of an entire day, on this particular day, the circulation is flowing the same direction all day long. I didn't realize that. So that's something that a pattern that I saw in the representation that was not something that I expected. But another way to represent this particle flow, here's the case where the vectors are going out, they're coming back in, but the water's still going out. Another way to represent this data is through the particles themselves. I'm gonna now put a grid of particles. Okay, I don't know if you can see those. Yeah. And now I'm going to let the circulation move those particles around. So I'm going to start time. And this is another way to represent the movement. Now in this case, that is the position of the particles. Now you will occasionally see they will wash up on shore, and that's a numerical error. That's an artifact of the sampling grid size of the data set. The particles eventually get moved to a point where there's zero velocity in the model, and so they tend to get stuck. But here's a different representation.
I think we've got to head out. I know some people have classes, but if you do want to stay, there's probably a few minutes after if you want to have Peter try it. Let's take Peter.
Thank you.
Class, so people have a couple questions.
Oh, yes. I'll be happy to stick around.